Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, I share ideas and strategies. I tell stories of things that worked, but also those big epic fails that I made along the way, because ultimately I believe that teachers are critical for helping students reach their creative potential. And one of the things I love to do is to talk to experts, and to talk to experts in all kinds of different fields. Today, we're going to be having an expert on AI. It's been a topic that I've been really into, that I've been sharing a lot about. And it's a topic that's actually going to be what I explore in my upcoming book that'll be due out in the next couple months called The AI Roadmap. It's all about what it means to do authentic human learning in an age of smart machines. But I really enjoyed this particular interview. And what I love is it is someone who is thinking really intentionally and strategically about data and the role of data in AI. So this is an interview with Dr. Mark Schneider. He's the director of the Institute of Education Sciences. Before joining IES, Dr. Schneider was a vice president and an institute fellow at American Institutes for Research, AIR, and president of College Measures. Prior to joining AIR, Dr. Schneider served as commissioner of the National Center for Education Statistics from 2005 to 2008. In 2013, the Chronicle of Higher Education selected him as one of the 10 people who had the most impact on higher education policy that year. In addition, Dr. Schneider is the author of numerous articles and books on education policy, including his most recent book, The University Next Door, which I really loved. Published by Teachers College Press, Columbia University. Dr. Schneider was a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and distinguished professor emeritus of political science at the State University of New York, Stony Brook. Again, this is a fun interview. It's a deep dive into AI and data and what this means and what this looks like. So I hope you enjoy this interview as much as I enjoyed getting a chance to give this interview. All right, we have with us here Dr. Schneider. Glad to have you here on this podcast.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
As we get started, you talk about the top three trends in education research for 2023. We're going to get into that in a little bit, but I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the Institute of Education Sciences first for people that aren't familiar with that.
Sure. So IES, the Institute of Education Sciences, is a nonpartisan, semi-autonomous, semi-independent science agency that sits inside the U.S. Department of Education. Mm-hmm. So its budget this year is about $800 million, which in the real world is a lot of money, but in the federal world, it's not that much. We're we could fit into a corner of NSF, and I don't even think NIH would even know if we were there or not, right? But on the other hand, I mean, we are one of the world's largest investors in education research. Mm-hmm. We have four centers. We have the National Center for Special Education Research. We have the National Center for Education Research. The difference between the two is the letter S for special ed. Mm-hmm. And we have the National Center for Education Statistics, NCES, which some people in your audience may have heard about. Mm-hmm. NCES is a component part of IES, and they run NAEP, the National Assessment Education Progress, which I'm sure most of your audience would know.
Yeah.
And the fourth center is the National Center for Education Evaluation and Regional Assistance. And that is that runs ERIC, which the teachers in your audience will probably remember encountering ERIC when they were in graduate school.
Yeah.
And the one thing I should tell you is if you have terrible memories of ERIC, because it was an awful, difficult system to negotiate when you're in graduate school, you should go back and take a look at it, because we spent a lot of time and energy and money rebuilding it. So it should be a much easier experience. And if you don't need it, don't do it. But if, and just in case you're curious, we have actually heard many teachers complaining about it, and we have been in the process of modernizing it. And NCEE, the National Center for Education Evaluation and Regional Systems, also runs the RELS, the Regional Education Laboratories, which some of your reader listeners would probably know. And if they don't know, and they're teachers, they should go look at the local REL. There are 10 regional RELS. Each, the U.S. is divided into 10 regions. And actually, the RELS have enormously enormous resources that that might be helpful to teachers. Mostly what the RELS do is deal with state education agencies, the education commissioners, and sometimes governors, sometimes LEAs, the local school districts, and solve problems of practice that the state SUPs or the local have identified. We've been trying to make sure that all of the material that the RELS produce, in fact, all the materials that IES produces, are more user-friendly, easier to access, and use plain language. So we're trying to do shorter, punchier reports. We also do something called practice guides, which some of your readers, listeners would probably know about. And if not, they should look at those too.
Yeah. So as I hear you describing this, one of the things I'm struck by is the challenges of making research accessible to current practitioners, right? So as someone in higher education right now, that's a conversation we have, how do you make things accessible, right? To people who are busy, when I think about my 12 years as a K-12 classroom teacher, as a middle school teacher, I loved research. I nerded out on it. I felt like it was the foundation that you build your practice upon. The craft of teaching is that combination of the research and then the artistry and all of it together. And so for me, I always loved it. I felt like what we should be doing should be, informed by research. At the same time, I recognized it's hard to stay up to date. It's hard to pay attention to everything when you're grading so many different papers, when you're lesson planning, when you're, have parent meetings and IEPs and all these different things. So I'm curious, what have you found that has worked in terms of helping the research become practical and accessible to current practitioners?
Well, I mean, that's the biggest challenge. I think that IES is 20 years old, and I think that that's been the challenge through its whole life. People talk about relevance and rigor, and, sometimes we've been too heavy on the rigor, sometimes not heavy enough on the rigor. So so our mandate, our congressional charter, calls for us to do rigorous research and then to disseminate that. So, I'm going to, be pretty honest, right? No, I'm not going to be pretty honest. I'm going to be very honest. It's a very hard balance to get, right? It's really hard to do rigorous research and then translate it into usable actions. And we've been struggling with that. I think we're not the only, organizations, science agency that's been struggling with that. I think it's really hard. So the other thing, of course, is the U.S. is a continental-sized country, right? It has everything in it. It also has 14,000 school districts, each of which is an independent government. It has, 50 states and the District of Columbia and outlying territories, Puerto Rico, Guam, et cetera. If you think about, and each one of these districts is some of them are radically different, right? Half the districts are or maybe one school, right? They're small, many are rural. And then we have, these monsters like, and I don't mean this in a pejorative sense. They're big, they're giant, right? Like New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, right? We're talking about big systems, right? And even within the system like New York or Los Angeles. We're talking about enormous variation, and then repeat that, you know, between a rural school district in North Dakota and New York or, you know, or Minneapolis. And like, what do we got? We got a lot of stuff. So part of the problem is identifying practices that work. But when we say practices that work, it may work in Minneapolis, but not in, you know, Fargo, or it may work mm-hmm. for Black students in Philadelphia, but not for Hispanic students in Los Angeles. So we're trying to walk a fine line between saying here are practices that work, mm-hmm. but really what we should be saying is here are things that are most likely to work for you, mm-hmm. your students, your school, and your community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of our problems has been in the past that we've tried to create general rules of, you know, rigor and science of learning. But the fact of the matter is that all we could really be saying is like, here's the evidence
mm-hmm.
that says for students like yours and schools like yours and communities like yours, here are things that are likely to work. Mm-hmm. There's no guarantee, right? But here are things that are more likely to work than these other things that don't fit your profile, that don't fit your needs, that don't fit your students, that don't fit your communities. And I think that is it sounds strange to say this is a realization that took some time to get because it's so obviously true.
Mm-hmm.
But for a long time, we were looking for, you know, the science of education that would transcend, you know, the individual reality that mm-hmm. teachers face every day that they walk into a classroom, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's no use for me to tell you that this practice worked for, you know, Hispanic students in Los Angeles and you're in, you know, in Iowa.
Yeah.
So so one of the things that we've been working on is trying to improve the fit of recommendations against populations.
One of the things that I'm reminded of when you describe that is, you know, a lot of education leaders have gravitated toward these big meta analyses. And I think of, you know, the number of principals and superintendents that I know, for example, who are huge fans of, you know, Marzano and Hattie. And a lot of times in the simplification of research, you end up with these, you know, effect size numbers. And I remember seeing an interview with John Hattie, where they ask specifically about the low effect size of inquiry-based learning. And I'm a big fan of inquiry-based learning within the sciences, right? So when I taught all subjects, I found inquiry-based learning really worked for conceptual understandings, for sort of the stickiness of learning, of it being permanent. But I also felt like you have to have a concept attainment lesson, front-loaded vocabulary, things like that first. And I remember in this interview, he basically says, well, inquiry-based learning on its own, it has a low effect size, but if you do this front-loaded vocabulary, all the things that I had seen myself as a teacher, right, then it has a higher effect size. And it was this reminder for me of Hattie's research wasn't wrong. It was great, right? The challenge was that people read this chart in reading his book, and they said, this works based on effect size. And they were internalizing this message of just use whatever has a high effect size, not realizing the effect size changes when you do something first, right? These things move back and forth. It's much more complicated. And it was a reminder for me of the challenge, a little bit of what you described, of oversimplifying research. Right. Because, right. So every time research is published, it says here are the limitations, you know, here's the context. And then you strip all of that into a table, you know, it becomes a challenge.
Right. So there are a couple of things in what you just said. So the first thing is when we talk about effect sizes, that's too often we're talking about the average effect size.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Which, again, I mean, my whole thinking about all this is like, none of us are average,
right? right.
Right. So I don't need to know that there's an average effect, right? Right. Which is important, by the way, because, you know, in general, you don't want to do any harm. And if you have a negative effect You got to be really careful, right? But then, so there could be, I mean, we see this all the time, right, in studies. There could be a very low average effect, but one population has a very large effect, right? Mm-hmm. This intervention has a very large effect on this particular population. So the fixation, right, the fixation on average effects was not good, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it was like 1950s medicine in 2020. So what we're really talking about increasingly is individualized instruction, mm-hmm. right? And we'll get around to the role of AI, for example, in modern technologies in individualized instruction. So what we're talking about is, you know, if I went to the doctor and I show up in the doctor and he says, well, on average, you're okay, but, you know, too bad your hand is falling off or something mm-hmm. like that, right? Yeah. But on average, you're fine. And I say, well, what about this hand that's hanging, you know, from some, you know, it's not working. And well, on average, you're fine. And it's not a good argument. What we really need to do is we need to think much more about the individual cases that are before us, like every one of these students. I mean, this is why teaching is such a hard job. I taught in a middle school for several years. It was the hardest job I've ever had in my entire life. I mean, I don't think there's any question. I mean, I have enormous respect for teachers who are able to, you know, I mean, I couldn't do it. I just could not do it. And I have enormous respect for teachers that, you know, day in, day out, year after year, go in there and you know, I almost said fight the good fight, but that sounds like too confrontational, but it's, yeah. You know what I mean? It's like, you do your job. Your job is to improve students. Your job is to make sure students learn. You know, and they're healthy in their heads, they're healthy in their bodies, they're healthy, they understand stuff. I mean, it's an amazingly important job, really difficult. Mm-hmm. But each one of these kids shows up every day. They're different, right? And you have to figure out how best to solve that problem, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you're in a class, and it drove me crazy. I was in a class with, you know, 30 kids. Some of them were highly literate and other ones, you know, couldn't read.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And I mean, that, and you know, so we need to figure out within the constraints of large classes and, you know, credible demands, we need to figure out how to support teachers better so that they could be where the student is. And again, an average effect of, you know, 0.3 sounds good, but what happens if it was average across students that aren't in your classroom? Like, that don't look anything like the kids in your class, that don't do, they, you know, don't face the same problems as the students in your class. It's a really difficult problem. And you know, so again, I think the model that we had for too long was 1950s medicine, right? Mm-hmm. Here's a pill, take it, right? And on average, you'll be okay. Well, then it turns out that, you know, for example, the DNA of some populations means that the pill's not going to work the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, we've moved over the last decades, several decades, into much more individualized medicine.
Yeah, I love that metaphor, that kind of comparison, because I think that's, you know, that's definitely the case. I remember as a classroom teacher doing action research and discovering that my students who were mostly ELL, right, they had come from either they were currently in the English language learning program, or they had just exited and they were functional English proficiency. And what I found was in action research, which is, I know, not as rigorous and all that kind of stuff, but just in my own classroom, doing the data, looking at it, discovering that my students did not understand word problems, not because of vocabulary, which is the assumption. It was because of the grammatical structure of word problems. It was because of passive voice. It was because of the past perfect progressive verb tense. And I tested out, you know, and looked at what happens when you explicitly teach grammar and syntax in short bursts and cover each of the verb tense formulas. What happens in terms of understanding and solving complex math problems? And I'm reminded that absolutely worked for me. That would have been a waste of time for my own children. Like they would have just said, why are we doing this in a math class? You know, and it just goes to show just how contextual those pieces are.
So you touched on something that I think is really important. I mean, and this is a very large, powerful trend in education research. Mm-hmm. And that is to, and there are all kinds of words, like, you know, having teachers do research with us instead of us researching on them, mm-hmm. right? And the same thing with students. So I think, this is, you know, it's not an, it's somewhat controversial, right? But a teacher walks into a classroom, they have 25, 30 students, whatever they have. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they're not scientists, then they're not doing their job, right? What you just said is a scientific experiment, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have a problem. I'm trying different solutions to it. I'm measuring what happens. I'm trying to understand. I'm updating. I'm, you know, reapplying my methods with mm-hmm. more knowledge that I've learned from studying data and looking at. Well, look, I mean, all humans are mm-hmm. scientists, right? I mean, if you weren't, you know, testing the environment and like, hey, what happens if I walk in front of this car? You know, I mean, you die, right? But like, it doesn't take many instances of, you know, doing stupid things to figure out like, hey, that was really stupid. I'm not going to touch that stove. I'm not going to, you know, jaywalk. I'm not going to do this and that. But we're always updating our experiences. We're always experiencing the world, right? In collecting data and then trying to update our knowledge. And I think what you're describing is a perfect example of what a good teacher can do, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, here's students. They're having some problems that I'm not quite sure why they're having them. So mm-hmm. let me try some experiments. So these are not RCTs, they're not randomized controlled trials, they're not, mm-hmm. you know, the gold standard, but they're observational studies, right? Based on an intelligent, well-trained human standing in front of 30 kids, 25 kids, whatever, and saying like, hey, I need to, this seems to work better than that. That's mm-hmm. an experiment, right? Mm-hmm. And then I'm collecting data and then I'm updating. And then I'm going to like, okay, that's interesting. Or I'm going to go to, the What Works Clearinghouse, or I'm going to mm-hmm. take a practice guide, or I'm going to call my friend, you know, I'm going to go to Pinterest, whatever we do. And mm-hmm. and I'm going to say, hey, this seems to have some appeal. It appeals to me logically. There's good evidence for it. Let me try to implement this.
Yeah. It's right? interesting that you brought up the, you know, all the different places we go. And one of the things I found fascinating was the way that the pre-service teachers I work with right now are currently using AI in ways that surprise me. So I'm just going to give two quick examples.
Yeah.
One was the other night I taught class and a teacher who speaks English, but his native language is Spanish, took the class transcript from Zoom that I make available to everyone. And he ran that through a chatbot, stripped it of the timestamps, and then had it also translate it into Spanish. And so it was, you know, he had it in both languages and he took notes both in Spanish and English, and he's, you know, teaching in a bilingual classroom. Fascinating to see his use of AI. Another student, we read both from popular and scholarly sources in terms of trying to understand and, you know, make sense out of information and research. And, you know, this student, her first step with the journal articles that we were looking at on questioning techniques was to begin there, use AI to simplify the language first, and then do a second reading with the more complex language. And it just surprised me. I mean, I didn't model it. I didn't show it. I didn't, and everyone's really concerned right now. I'll tell you, in higher ed, they're really worried about academic integrity and all these different concerns. But it was just interesting to see that in one night, how students were already using it in ways that I just didn't predict.
So, you know, I mean, so obviously we had to get here sooner or later. So
yes.
Here we are.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, so first of all, ChatGPT came out on November 30th.
Right? Yeah.
So we're talking about what? Let's see, December, January, February, 3 months. We're into 3 months into something that's clearly revolutionary. We need to start there. The yeah. second thing is that, you know, AI ChatGPT was designed to optimize only a limited set of things, right? It's designed to be coherent. is designed to write, you know, a pretty good English. It's designed not to have spelling errors. It's designed to say, hey, here's this these few words, the best bet for the next word. You know how this works. It's like, you know, just by, you know, like there's something here, right? And this is what it does. So right now, again, 3 months into this revolution, we have a tool that can write pretty good English, right? No spelling errors, which, as you know, for most American classrooms is a major win,
yes,
right? I mean, you know, it's a major, major win. But, you know, it wasn't optimized. It was not optimized for correctness.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So the next generation, obviously, and I think Bing is and Microsoft are actually changing the parameters so that there not only is it going to be grammatically correct and no spelling errors, but it's going to be more likely to be correct, factually correct.
Yes.
So there are two things that we need to know. So the first thing is, and this is really important, right? No matter how good these algorithms get, we as humans consuming this information or, you know, or asking the generative AI to produce it, we have a responsibility to look at that, right? And to correct it to the best of our information, the best of our knowledge. And that, by the way, is a different mindset than the way we've treated research by student research for almost forever. Right. So we need to think about what in this new world literacy really is and what the literacy skills are.
Yeah.
This is not a trivial issue, by the way.
No.
This is not a trivial issue. This is like, I mean, this is fundamental, right, to the way in which schools are run and the task of schools, which is to inculcate literacy. Right. So we need to do that. The second thing, which is a little bit in the weeds, is that one of the things that we've learned is that any of these generative AI system, in fact, any AI system is only as good as the data it ingests.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. And when we start getting into technical education issues, and I'm not talking about like bizarre technical, I'm talking about reading and writing and arithmetic, right? The data sets that we have are extremely limited. So, you know, I mean, you need 100,000 answers to train an AI system on, right? 50,000, 100,000, you need a lot. And actually, there are not that many large student-based data systems that are available that could be used to train AI systems. So we've been working here to take the NAEP student answers for writing, reading, and arithmetic, and to make them more widely available to researchers to train AI systems that will be better for our particular education challenges than just the, sort of whatever's lying around on the internet. And this is, I mean, we have to protect student privacy. I mean, everything that we have to do, we're doing, but we need to make these data available. I think today is Monday, tomorrow. So this is Monday. I don't know when this is going to be released, but this is Monday, the 6th. I think tomorrow or Wednesday, the 7th or the 8th, we're going to announce using NAEP student responses to the math test, a competition to try to use this large data set to train AI systems to help us understand better where students go off the track on mathematics.
Yeah.
So for example, you know this, right? I mean, you if you look at a student's work, step one, oh, you got that. Step two, you got that. Step three, you got that. And step four, like, what? What happened here? So one possibility is lack of knowledge, right? And our job as teachers is to solve that. But another problem can be a math misconception, right? Like, I don't even know what the order of operations are, right? So I solve it this way, but it really the order of operations said it should have been solved this other way, right? And and again, I mean, any good teacher will discover this by looking at 30 papers, but if you want to train a system for like interacting with students as they're sitting and doing a math test, you need to be able to identify all the math misconceptions that students often have in their heads, so that we could design an AI system that intervenes early enough and says, hey, look, you do pluses and minuses, multiplication, division, and then pluses and minuses. You have to have the order operation. This is what parens do to change the order operation. But you need to understand that this is where your student is going off the rails, right? And you have to be able to design an intervention that catches that early and then tutors the student about, again, I keep using the order operation, which is extremely simple, but, this is what the order operation is. This is how you do it. This is the right way of doing it. Right? But, I mean, you and I could say, this is the order operations and this is how you solve this problem. But the fact of the matter is, if you're testing in a state, hundreds of thousands of students, tens of thousands of students, you need something, or you need something better. Or if you're trying to design an AI tutor, you need something, you need something that's much more calibrated and that picks up, issues quicker.
It's so interesting that you mentioned the tutoring piece, because one of the things I've noticed with that is a lot of people have pointed out in ChatGPT in particular how poorly it does at giving advice on sort of procedural math, like the order of operations and things like that. And part of it is people aren't necessarily putting in prompts correctly. There's this whole challenge. Some of what people are saying, I told it to do blank and it told me the answer is blank or the way to do it is blank. And I'll say, well, actually what you think that you did was not what you did. So some of it is learning how to produce better prompts. Some of it is the AI responding to the prompts. That being said, I'm fascinated by how well it does at the conceptual side of math, right? So if you ask sort of ChatGPT, or I've done the same thing with Bing with their new AI, it does a really good job. Say, if you say, what is a p-value? How does it work? What is the difference between, when would you use a p-value? When would you not? Does the information have to be experimental? Can you give me an example of p-value we would see in basketball? It does a really good job explaining sort of the conceptual side of, I use p-value because my oldest is taking, AP statistics, and he literally, I was explaining p-value to him and I was like, I've got quant research in my background. Like, I know it. And he wasn't getting it. And then when he had the ability to ask these follow-up questions and clarifying questions, it did a phenomenal job. And when you add that to eventually having video and photo examples, it's going to be powerful. But that being said, one of my concerns is we already know that AI can be biased and struggles with both bias and context, right? And knowing that sometimes that's a reality, I get concerned at how often I see already students going to ChatGPT and forgetting bias can still exist within the system, right? And when they've suddenly used a chatbot for the purpose of essentially tutoring, where you need them to trust and pay attention, there's this danger that I see of you go to a tool for trust that still has some real big issues of bias. What is that going to mean for students growing up with that?
So there are a couple of things here. So the first one is, I understand that this is a serious problem, but this all goes back to the training date.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And that's why, for me, for example, in reading, writing and math, right, we do have large data sets that we've been sitting on for literally decades that we can release that can help deal with this problem. Mm-hmm. So the nice thing about NAEP is it has all these student essays, for example. I'm just going to use a writing example, but we have math and reading. We also have the context, because I don't know if you've ever seen the NAEP thing, but NAEP assessment. But not only are they asking about problems, but you also provide information about your background.
Yeah.
So this is amazing, because most large data sets don't have that student or contextual information. So NAEP has an assessment, but also has questions about your community, about your school, about your teachers, about your demographics. So this is an incredibly, and it's a nationally representative sample. So if you think about it, this is an unparalleled quality in terms of the ability to train and deal with issues like bias. Mm-hmm. The second thing is, and this is going to be a real, real challenge. I'm going to give you an example of something that we're funding that I think is for me the future. So so people keep thinking like, oh, you know, AI is going to get rid of humans, right?
Right.
Why do we need humans for? So the funny thing is we could use ChatGPT to generate essays. And then there are, as you know, grading bots that grade essays. Mm-hmm. So like, hey, I don't need a human anymore. Like I can have a bot write the essay and a bot grade the essay. Then I'm going home and playing video games. Right. But I mean, that is, and you know, I mean, because humans are essentially, you know, energy conserving. I was going to say lazy, but they're really not lazy. They just conserve energy, right? Yeah. I mean, that's part of what we do. So like, hey, why do I need to worry about this if I have a bot that could do this and a bot that could do that? I'm just like going home, right? Mm-hmm. But here, let me give you an example of what I think the future looks like. And this is a little specialized. So I'm still trying to, all of us are trying to figure out exactly the generalizability of this and how much this could actually work in a more general setting. So the issue is speech language pathologies. Mm-hmm. So there are millions of kids, right, that have speech language pathologies, SLP. Mm-hmm. And we don't have enough pathologists in schools. And part of the reason we don't have enough pathologists in schools is it's a very hard job, right? It's rewarding in its own right, but you have too many students. You mentioned earlier, like how much time people spend on IEPs. Well, can you imagine if you're a pathologist and you're dealing with students with speech language pathologies? Estimates are as much as half of your life is spent doing IEPs.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then and there's not enough. So A, there are not enough pathologists. B, they're, you know, we kill them with paperwork. Okay, mm-hmm. So we just funded in conjunction with the National Science Foundation a $20 million AI institute, mm-hmm. focused on speech language pathologies. Mm-hmm. And this is and there's six or seven strands to it, but here are the three that I think are the easiest to understand. A universal screener, mm-hmm. right? So right now, I'm a speech pathologist. There's one of me in the school, two of me in the school. I have, you know, dozens, hundreds of kids, and I have to diagnose them. So boom, you know, like I give them a 10-minute assessment and then like I gotta guess them what they are. Well, what happens if we have an AI-assisted universal screener? Mm-hmm. So I can spend, you know, if I'm a kid, I can spend a half an hour, 40 minutes, assuming that the interface is fun and enjoyable, right? I mean, I could spend as much time as I need and get a very accurate diagnosis.
Yeah.
The second part is coming up with a treatment plan, right? So we know, I mean, this happens all the time in medicine, right? I go in, my doctor takes some tests, he talks to me, right? He enters all these data, right? I mean, I can't remember last time in a doctor's office where, you know, the doctor doesn't have an iPad or a laptop and typing away. Yeah. It's a little, I mean, in some ways it's a little aggravating. Like, look at me, talk to me.
Yeah.
Okay. But nonetheless, I mean, he's doing what he has to do, right? Putting in this information to get a diagnosis, an accurate diagnosis, and ultimately an accurate treatment plan. So if we use AI for those two purposes, right, we can imagine better diagnoses and better designs of treatment plans, right? Mm-hmm. And the third part of this is like IEPs are tedious and they're repetitive. Mm-hmm. Well, let's see, what have we just invented that could solve repetitive, tedious.
Yeah. Tasks, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So what happens? Imagine this. The three things that, again, there's six or seven strands, but now we have AI assisted diagnosis, AI assisted treatment plans, mm-hmm. and freeing up teachers from nonsense paperwork. Mm-hmm. Well, the whole purpose of this is not to replace teachers, mm-hmm. but to free teachers up to do what only teachers can do.
Yeah.
Right. To deal with students on an individual level basis, to figure out exactly where they are, exactly what they need, to work with them in an individualized basis instead of sitting around doing IEPs.
Yeah.
So for me, this, and I think this is a harbinger of the future, right? It's not replacing teachers. No, never, never, never. It is freeing teachers up to do what only they could do.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is the goal. Mm-hmm. I mean, the goal is to do that. And in so doing, what we're talking about is much more individualized attention and individualized instruction, in which the teacher can, or the speech pathologist can bring to bear the maximum of their skills and their time, right, dealing with individual students who need their attention and their help. Yeah. I mean, for me, this is like the future, mm-hmm. right? And we just started this, by the way. We announced it, a little after ChatGPT.
Yeah.
But ChatGPT was in the wind, so they were able to include it, generative AI in the proposal. But the fact of the matter is, like, there are persistent gaps, ELL, for example, right? Mm-hmm. English language learning. I mean, we could think about all these gaps that exist that we just don't have the personnel to do what teaching should be all about. And to the extent to which we could actually harness AI to change the landscape, mm-hmm. that to me is a brilliant future.
Yeah.
That's the future that I want to see.
I get excited, as you described that. It reminds me, I was thinking about what does assessment look like in the future? And it's so funny that you brought that up with speech pathologists. I hadn't even considered it because I thought at some point speech recognition is going to get so good. And it's so close already that I imagined that there will be a time where daily or weekly students will be able to do their fluency tests and reading and get a score immediately with the number of mistakes, the fluency score, everything done that way rather than the teacher sitting and screening. And I mentioned that because, I can't tell you how many early elementary school teachers in particular spend a lot of time doing one-on-one, DIBLs or whatever their assessment they're using. And in the meantime, what they could be doing is pulling small groups, meeting with a student. The data ends up coming every 2 to 3 weeks rather than daily or weekly. And so I get excited about when AI does assessment well, then that frees teachers up to do the human side, that dynamic side, the contextual side, of assessment that honestly they love, right? Because I can tell you, as someone who had to do that one time when, on my prep period, when I lost the prep period and had to walk in and cover, it gets repetitive and boring. And then you as a teacher begin to make mistakes, where you don't
know, because you're bored, you're not engaged,
you can't stay focused. So I get excited about that. One thing that I am curious about, and this could be too much in the weeds, is you brought up earlier sort of the role of AI with tutoring, and I see a lot of promise there. One of the challenges I see is what will be the pedagogical foundation of tutoring. In other words, I've seen, for example, AI that promises to help with tutoring. It gives some good feedback, but it's using a lot of positive phrases that if you're someone who is really concerned about growth mindset and grit, there's a concern about positive praise in what this was programmed to do. The positive praise is almost always aimed at the person. You're a great reader, that kind of stuff, rather than praising effort or praising the results of it. And I look at it and say, someone in an ed tech company didn't think about that element of human psychology, right? And then I worry in the same way, the teacher side of me is concerned about how will an AI learn, for example, that immediate feedback is vital, but so is productive struggle, right?
So
does that make sense? Like, I'm really curious you're going to train the AI on those sides,
right? So the answer has to be The answer has to be the fact that we are in a market, a huge market, by the way, mm-hmm. right? And ed tech companies produce tons of material, right? And yeah. some of it is good, some of it works, and some it doesn't. And some and a lot of it, as you well know, just I mean, it was the equivalent of when, you know, a new textbook showed up and the principal put it in the basement because they didn't know how to distribute it, or they didn't, you know, right. And it's just, we just spent, you know, $50,000 on textbooks, and where are the textbooks? Oh, they're in the basement. Right. So we know that a lot of tech products are, you know, people buy them for a variety of reasons. I've been to, you know, a lot of these tech fairs, and it's a lot of it is snake oil. Right. Mm-hmm. So the question is, like, we can't regulate this market. This market is too yeah. vibrant and too many things. I mean, I'm sorry, we can't over-regulate it. Yeah. We have to regulate to some extent, but we can't over-regulate it because it's too vibrant. Too many things are going on. And the last thing we want to do is we don't want to lock in today's advances and tools and like use them forever. So that's a problem. The other problem, which is, and I'm not sure, we've been struggling with this for some time, is that tech companies are, you know, they have proprietary IT. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, they do testing. They do a lot of testing. And like, hey, could you give IES access to these data so we could certify that this works, or we could help you identify, you know, the conditions under which this works and for whom? And, you know, they have proprietary IT. They're not giving it up. Mm-hmm. So somewhere along the line, and I think the only way this is, and I'm making this up right now, so I haven't put a lot of thought into this. I think the only way that this is going to work is for schools to become more serious about the data, mm-hmm. right? About the evidence that this thing works. Mm-hmm. And you know, I mean, they're buying, you know, tons of stuff, mm-hmm. but I appreciate your podcast for this. So part of what we have to do is we have to get the decision makers in school districts mm-hmm. or states to say, hey, here are, you know, 20 products. Which one's going to work for my kids?
Yeah.
Right. And that's a mindset issue, right? Mm-hmm. That needs to be I'm sorry. So mm-hmm. nobody's buying a product that they don't think is going to work. But mm-hmm. the question is, like, what's the evidence? And how compelling does that evidence have to be for a principal or a curriculum leader to say, you know, that really, that's the odds are, and again, nothing is a guarantee, the odds are that will fit my needs, my school's needs. So I think we should we should do that X rather than product Y. Because mm-hmm. product Y sounds like it's good. The average effect size is big. But if you look at the populations that it works on, it doesn't work on my population. Mm. And you know, I mean, this goes back to something we started with, like teachers as scientists, mm-hmm. right? They can understand data if it's presented, yeah, right? And absolutely. They can, and they also see, right? I mean, uh-huh. like, hey, this thing's supposed to work. I'm doing my best at it, and I can't make it work. Mm-hmm. Well, we need that kind of feedback, right?
Yeah, absolutely. My last question is just, looking forward, as you think about AI, thinking about the role of data, thinking about the speed, right, the rate of change of all of this, what excites you the most about the upcoming years as we think about both research and AI?
So, so I'm not sure how many of you maybe. You know or don't, but I, you know, so we have spent, the nation has spent $1 billion building state longitudinal data systems. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've even, right. So yeah, exactly. That's the point.
So, I think it's good, but I mean,
okay. So think of it this way, right? Your dog is moving around.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
it's fine. It's not barking, which was, I thought next. So, you know, hundreds of thousands of students did not show back up to school after the pandemic, yeah. right? So the rate of chronic truancy. is way higher than I mean, it's unbelievably high, mm-hmm. right? So the way it works now is, like, I mean, schools take attendance every day in part, they report it to somebody because they get paid by average daily attendance, right? So there are systems out there that are tracking student enrollment, absenteeism. That gets reported, you know, to the state like once a month, every other month, once a quarter, right? In the meantime, some kid could have fallen through the cracks for 6 weeks, right? And we don't even know about it. I mean, the school knows about it. The teacher may know about it, but there's no systematic reporting of chronic truancy. So what would happen if we had a whole child system built on the SLDS, for example? So I know this kid. I know this kid is, you know, I know his immigration status. I know her food insecurity issues. I know whether or not she's an illegal immigrant. I know I know whether or not. So when I was teaching in New York City, I mean, kids would come in with the, for middle class person, these were like insane stories. Like, you know, my the hotel I was living in burned down last night. Right. I mean, this happens. Well, okay. And I remember this lovely young woman, a young girl. She was like such a dedicated student. And one day she just came in and her eyes were literally rolling around in her head. And I said, what's going on? You know, you're not paying attention. And she said, I saw a man with all his bones out. And I said, like, what are you talking about? So it turned out that she was living in a hotel, a welfare hotel. And the elevator door opened, but the car wasn't there. And some guy was drunk or drugs and walked into the elevator shaft, fell down six stories, crashed at the bottom of the elevator shaft, and his bones came out.
Oh my gosh.
Right. So like, yo, do your homework. Where's your, where's your math answers? Like, so if we had a much better system about what's going on in kids' lives, we might be able to identify problems earlier. We might be able to identify points of intervention earlier. And I'm not talking about, I mean, schools are amazing because they do so many things to kids. But, you know, there are other people out there, right? I mean, there are health systems and social justice systems and, you know, welfare and this and that, immigration. I mean, all these things need to be talking to each other, right? So what would happen if we had, and I mean, in some ways, it's a little scary because it's like Big Brother. But the fact of the matter is, if we want to know more about why kids are chronically absent, there are systems out there that can help us understand that and could help identify points of intervention that could help a student before they go too far off the rails. So for me, this big data revolution, it can be as important as AI because in fact they go together.
Yeah, I never considered that, but yeah, the role of lateral, you know, data going
integration,
back and forth, integration, combine that with machine learning. Yeah, really with the goal of focusing on the human side at the same time, right? You know, and
so,
I think
so this is
ultimately what it does.
Right. So this is the warning, right? I mean, you know, we could think about Big Brother. We could think about, you know, in autocracies, the degree to which they control behavior, and that's all scary. So the two things that are most important is, you know, protection of privacy while we're doing this, right? And the goal always has to be, and I think you just said it, you know, humans. It's not a machine. We're talking about freeing up humans to do what humans can do best.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time. I think that's a great piece to end with right there. I love that idea. Again, thank you so much for just sharing your wisdom, your ideas on this podcast. Any final thing where people could reach out or something you want people to check out?
Well, I you don't do videos. This is only
audio. No, this is not video. Yeah, it's just
nobody's going to know about your hat.
Yeah, I've got a hat. I've got a hat right now with the Great Dane.
But you can set up a side business with that. It's a very nice hat.
All right, thank you so much.
All righty. All right. Good talking to you, John.
Yeah, good talking to you too.
So there you have it. That was Dr. Mark Schneider. I really enjoyed this interview and just the perspective that he offers as someone who understands the science of data and AI and what that will look like in the future for us. This is another interview in this part on a series of AI and how it is changing education. I've got some really fun interviews that are coming up as well, so check those out as they drop. With a lot of different stakeholders and thinkers in different areas as we navigate what it means to do learning in a world of AI. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify, wherever it is that you get your podcast? Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.